Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our guest today says, we have been here before, amid a national moment of protest against racism and police brutality. And he's not just talking about the 1960s civil rights movement, familiar to most Americans, even if they didn't live through it. In his forthcoming book, Professor Matthew Delmont writes about the summer of 1943, when race riots or rebellions raged across the country. Most of these earlier conflicts, like the Black Lives Matter movement we see today, were sparked by police actions. Today in The Exchange, comparing protests now with protests past. Listeners, did you participate in earlier movements for racial justice or civil rights? How do you view what's going on currently? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Joining us for the hour is Matthew Delmont. He's the Sherman Fairchild Distinguished Professor of History at Dartmouth College, the author of three books on race in America. His forthcoming book is Half American, the epic story of African Americans fighting World War II at home and abroad. And Professor Delmont, a big welcome. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into some of these, you know, movements past that you've written about, and again, I don't know how many Americans know about what happened in the summer of 43. Here you are writing this book about these earlier movements, and then in your hometown, Minneapolis, a Black man is killed by police. It sparks a nationwide, even global movement against racism and police brutality. Talk about a confluence of events for you. How are you sorting through all this?
Yeah, so I have to say my mind's been kind of all over the place over the last couple of weeks. As you mentioned, I'm from Minneapolis. I grew up downtown Minneapolis, about 3 miles away from where George Floyd was killed. And so seeing the news from my hometown, talking to my family members who are still there, it's deeply upsetting, but also just kind of exhausting, which I think is something that a lot of Black Americans feel right now, because this is just, it's not new. I thankfully didn't have any direct interactions with the Minneapolis police growing up, but my dad told me stories from when I was very young of how him and his buddies got beat up by the police quite often. So it was always something that was sort of part of my knowledge of the city, even though Minneapolis has always been an overwhelmingly white city and considers itself a pretty liberal and progressive city. Sort of see it explode in this way into a national story has just been, it's been a lot to process. And then as a historian, it's actually been interesting because I work on this history. So I know the history of cities and policing and civil rights, but I've actually learned a lot about the place I grew up in the last couple of weeks. So learning about how the Minneapolis police force came to sort of take on this more racist character and how they've really been harassing African-Americans in the city for decades. That it wasn't just sort of anecdotal stories from my family members, but reading the research on it in the last couple of weeks is, as a historian, has actually helped me learn more about the place I grew up.
Wow, that's really interesting. So your dad used to tell you stories about he and his buddies being beat up by police in Minneapolis, and then here you are studying this from, you know, the ivory tower of academia at Dartmouth College. I mean, just what's that like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good reminder. I mean, the you can be a tenured professor, you can be professional class African-American, but these issues are never not part of your life. So me even living here in New Hampshire, again, another overwhelmingly white place, when I drop my kids off at school and they have the sort of community police there for the sort of meet the police days, I still tense up. It's something that you, even as a tenured professor at an Ivy League school, it's something that's never not part of my experience. And so to see it emerge again, I just keep thinking of how can we make sure that this time finally becomes a turning point? How can we make sure that this isn't something that happens generation in the future? Because it's really happened for the last 100 years, you could find examples of this. So I'm hopeful that this is finally a moment where we can address these issues head on.
Well, and I definitely want to ask you about, you know, the World War II era protests. I think you even write about, you know, in the 30s. I do want to follow up, though, on what you said, Professor, that this is upsetting and exhausting for Black people. And does writing about the history of this, the long history, the here we are again history, does that make it more upsetting and exhausting or less upsetting and exhausting?
Honestly, I think it depends on the day.
I think a lot of people feel that way these days.
Sometimes I'm grateful to be a historian because I can turn back to history and try to kind of find my bearings. I think that's how I feel most of the time. I can look back and get a better understanding of how did we end up here? Like, why are cities structured the way they are? Why are the racial hierarchy structured the way? How is it written into policy? And be able to try to offer explanations to my students, to my colleagues, to the public at large when I'm able to write things like op-eds. That makes me feel good. It feels like I have my research isn't just going to sit on the shelf somewhere, but it actually hopefully can help people understand how we got here and then chart a more just future. On other days, I kind of feel like, what's the point though? Because I felt this way in the first wave of Black Lives Matter protests 5 or 6 years ago. I could teach my students about the history of lynching. I could teach them about the history of Emmett Till. I could teach them about the Rodney King riots. But then 2014, 15, 16, Michael Brown, protests in Ferguson, what's going on in Freddie Gray in Baltimore, the same exact things are happening. I didn't feel like the kind of teaching I was doing, the kind of research I was producing, made any difference at all. So I really do feel like it's both. I feel like the work of historians, the work of other scholars has a real role we can play, but the problem is so immense, and the difficulty of getting people to put in place solutions, real solutions, is so difficult that sometimes it feels demoralizing.
Wow. Well, I want to invite our listeners to join us as well. Again, today in The Exchange, our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. And our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And we're going to spend the hour comparing protest movements against racial violence, against police brutality, protests now with protests past. And Exchange listeners, if you participated in earlier movements, we'd really like to hear from you how you view what's going on right now. Also, if this is your first time getting involved in this, we'd like to hear what you are learning from or pulling from movements past. Our number again, 1-800-892-6477. So let's talk about those earlier protests that you write about. And I'm really interested in the World War II racial violence that you've been writing about. Before we get to that, though, what predated those events? You just caught my interest. You said this goes back 100 years.
Yeah, it goes back 100 years at least. I mean, if we look back all the way to the summer of 1919, there were a number of racial attacks against African-American communities coming out of the end of World War I, also coming out of the flu pandemic of 1918. But you could pick any year from 1919 all the way up until this year, and you would find examples of police killings of African-Americans. Those instances and the kind of everyday police harassment, they continue to kind of fester within African-American communities. These are stories that get passed down from generation to generation. They're in part of the lived experience of these African-American communities. They only sometimes will emerge into large-scale uprising or large-scale public protests. But I think it's important when people see what's going on today that none of this is new. It's something that is always, it's always there, and it emerges kind of cyclically every generation or so into large-scale uprisings.
Well, it's interesting that you say 1919, and as you noted, the world was still in pandemic mode at that point, the Spanish flu, 1918, but there were still vestiges lurking in 1919. I want to ask you about World War II, and I'm guessing many white Americans view the home front as a time of incredible national unity, but you write, Professor Delmont, that it definitely was not. So what sparked these events that you call race riots or race rebellions?
Yeah, so there was a tremendous amount of racial unrest and racial tension during World War II. So it was far from being a time of national unity. Right in the middle of the war, in 1943, there were over 240 different racial attacks and racial conflicts all across the country, from large cities like Los Angeles, Detroit, New York, small towns like Beaumont, Texas. And a lot of them happened on military bases. A lot of these had to do with police conflicts with African-Americans, police violence against African-Americans. In New York, you had a police officer shoot and wound an African-American soldier. A lot of the protests that were happening around army camps were because the army was segregated. African-American troops felt that it was deeply unfair to be serving their country and being asked to ride in the back of buses and being put in substandard housing, but then the military police would kind of force them to endure this Jim Crow segregation. So you see these conflicts emerging all across the country, and almost all of it gets rooted back to the kind of police brutality and over-policing that African-American communities experienced.
Wow. Tell us a little bit more about that. That's interesting. On military bases or around military bases, what were some of the sort of instances that caused these things to blow up?
It's a lot of things you would see emerging later during the kind of mainstream era of the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s. So buses were actually a huge issue. You had African-American troops, many of them were from northern areas where they didn't have official segregation, being sent down to military bases in the South and then being forced to endure very, very harsh Jim Crow conditions, including riding in the back of buses. So you can just imagine the situation. You're an African-American soldier, you're dressed in your military uniform, but you're forced to assume this subjugated position and forced to take a seat in the back of the bus. A lot of these soldiers weren't willing to stand for it, but when they would raise their voices or would protest, either the bus drivers who were deputized to kind of take on the role of police or military police or city police would come in and in the police's words, put them back in their place, make sure that the African-American soldiers didn't get too uppity or get too high on the idea that they might have first-class citizenship. These stories then get circulated all across the country. So you have communities in northern cities and western cities that are dealing not only with their own police brutality in their own cities, but also reading about their sons and uncles and fathers who are serving in the military and being treated deeply unfairly. And it just, again, it festers. It creates this sort of bubbling anger among African-American communities that in many cases leads to large-scale protests or to uprisings.
Well, especially at a time when you are literally preparing to put your life on the line for your country. How were these described by the media at the time? I'm interested in what you just said about these stories from what happened at these military bases circulated even before things were shared on Twitter and other platforms.
Yeah, so it depends a lot on which media you were reading. So if you looked at the mainstream or the white press in most of these cities, they would blame any sort of conflicts or violence on African-Americans. They would say, you know, they were African-Americans who were drunk and disorderly outside of a bar, and that's what caused the police to come, and they sort of got what they deserved. Or there were African-American youth who were being hoodlums, who were wearing the fashion of the day was called the zoot suit. So it's sort of these flamboyantly dressed young people. These were the roots of the problems. If you were to look at Black media, however, African-American newspapers, they got more to the kind of structural issues. They would say that, you know, these things are kind of popping off right now, but the reason people are so upset is kind of twofold. One, that they've experienced the sort of steady drumbeat of segregation, of unfair housing, unfair schools, unfair jobs, police brutality. They've experienced it every day over the last decade. But then there's a sort of great paradox of serving your country, of seeing your relatives serve the country in a war that's supposedly going to bring about democracy worldwide. At the same time, you can't even get democracy in your own hometown. So depending on what media you would read, it either addressed the kind of structural concerns that African-Americans felt, or it would address, if you were reading white media, it would say, you know, African-Americans are getting out of their place. They're doing things that are untoward, and that's why the police are necessary.
How did the White House respond at the time? I thought that was really interesting, Professor Delmont, how the president and the vice president at the time responded to these riots.
Yeah, so the White House and public officials had to kind of choose their words very carefully. On the one hand, the White House understood that African Americans were an increasingly important voting demographic. So Roosevelt might not have won the election in 1940 without the African American vote. So he often, through his vice president, would sort of give stronger statements, sort of condemning the rioters. So there's a good quote by the vice president talking about sort of condemning the white rioters in Detroit who carried out this violence against African-Americans. And he said something to the effect of, you know, if you're doing this kind of violence against African-Americans, you're actually supporting the Nazis, right? And we can't have this kind of brutality in our own country because it's essentially supporting fascism. In sort of the broader conversation, there was still kind of a careful towing of the line because so much of the country in terms of white Americans wanted to maintain the racial status quo. They weren't necessarily fighting to try to increase equal rights for African Americans. They were fighting to maintain the kind of racial dominance and racial privileges they had going into the war. So for public officials, Roosevelt on down, there was a kind of very careful towing the line of how much you could say. And of course, the military was segregated throughout World War II. It doesn't desegregate until 1948. And so there's certain lines that public officials, people in power, just weren't willing to cross.
That quote by Vice President Wallace, I saw that in an article that you wrote. So interesting. He says, we can't have these race riots at home while we're, you know, fighting against Nazism abroad. But that came from the vice president, not the president. So that's kind of interesting. I just would love to hear a little bit more from you about that.
Yeah, so the vice president at the time was more liberal than Roosevelt was. And so Roosevelt, actually, after the Detroit riots, the NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which was the main civil rights organization at the time, they're pleading with Roosevelt to make this one of his fireside chats, to sort of address this head on. And he doesn't. He doesn't say anything about the riots for nearly a month. And when he does say something, it's a very kind of lukewarm general statement about the importance of fighting prejudice. And so I think it kind of cuts to what the United States was officially fighting for during World War II. For African Americans, sort of the famous saying was they're fighting a double victory campaign, victory over fascism and Nazism abroad, but also victory over racism at home. Like I said, for most white Americans, this would be Roosevelt on down. It wasn't a double victory campaign. It was much more of a single victory campaign, trying to achieve military victory over the Axis, over the Japanese, Germany, and Italy. But not doing anything more than they had to advance civil rights at home. Some of those advances came after the war, but during the war, it speaks to the fact that the military was segregated. That was not the most efficient way to conduct a world war, to have to build separate army bases and separate latrines and separate housing accommodations for all the troops. They did it because so many white Americans believed so strongly in racial segregation and white supremacy that they just couldn't imagine having a fully integrated military.
You're reminding me of what an enormous deal it was for President Truman to desegregate the military. I'm guessing there's at least a chapter in your forthcoming book about this, but just give us a little preview of how Truman comes in and he says, we really just can't keep doing this. How much did these protests and these riots that you're talking about play into his decision making?
So you're right. So President Truman desegregates the military in 1948. And so I think the fact that the United States and allies win the war and understand the sort of depths and horrors of what the Nazis had carried out in Germany, it does create space for a more honest reckoning with the evils of racism. At the same time, you have civil rights activists, many coming back who were veterans during the war. They just keep fighting. They arrive back in the United States. They're treated very horribly in many cases, but they just keep fighting to advance civil rights. One of the key issues that gets put forward initially is the desegregation of the military, both because it's a more just way to structure the military. They recognize that there's a lot of important training that happens there, that there are jobs that are going to happen there. But also, it was just a fundamental sign of disrespect to have a segregated military and to have African Americans sort of put in these lower level positions. So because of the civil rights activism and because of the kind of worldwide tenor of trying to move in a different direction than the sort of Nazis were trying to move with their vision of racial supremacy, it creates the push that Truman needs to sign that executive order desegregating the military.
Well, coming up pretty soon, Professor, I'm going to ask you about the civil rights movement in the 60s and so forth. But one last question for you on this era. Why is this time in our history so little known?
I think the mythical version of World War II that we tell ourselves, this time of national unity where Americans rallied together and defeated this horrible menace of Nazi Germany, right, and then came back and sort of took on worldwide leadership. It's such an appealing myth because it doesn't ask us to confront some of the uglier parts of that history, whether that's Japanese American internment, whether it's the large amounts of anti-Semitism that were happening in the United States, or whether it was the fact that we came back after winning a war and still maintained Jim Crow segregation in the South for another two decades. I think a more honest reckoning with that history is actually much more productive, because it helps us see that there isn't a sort of a kind, peaceful, racially harmonious time we can look back to in our nation's history. This has always been a fight. And I think if we can be honest about that in a period like World War II, it gives us more resources and better, a firmer footing or foundation to be able to understand how do we deal with things in 2020, right? We saw it happen in World War II. We didn't fix it then. We had some solutions and some advances, but how these many generations later can we do a better job?
Well, coming up, we will look at the 1960s civil rights movement parallels with today, and we'll hear from a UNH scholar who's written several books on that era. And we really hope to hear from you, Exchange listeners. If you were involved in civil rights movements and protests past, we'd love to hear your experiences then and how they compare to now. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us.
You listen to NHPR for breaking news and for stories that delve deeply into the details of what's happening in your community. I'm Jason Moon, NHPR health reporter. Your financial support right now makes this essential coverage possible. And when you give to NHPR today, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar. Make your impact go even further. Your $50 gift today will be doubled when you give now at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Before we return to our conversation, I'd like to remind you that during these extraordinary and difficult times, The Exchange is here for you every morning. We're live and local, discussing issues that affect you and your community. So while you're listening today, take a moment to let us know that this program matters to you. Make a donation by going online, nhpr.org, or call 1-800-586-4777. And thank you. Back to our conversation now about parallels between protests for racial justice now and movements past. And listeners, how do you view all this? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call in 1-800-892-6477. Joining us for the hour, Matthew Delmont. He's a history professor at Dartmouth College, the author of several books on race in America, including his next one that we were just talking about, titled Half American, the epic story of African Americans fighting World War II at home and abroad. And with us now is Jason Sokol, an associate professor of history at UNH and the author of several books, including All Eyes Are Upon Us, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn. And Professor Sokol, welcome back. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, thanks, Laura, and hi, Matt. Really enjoyed listening to you.
Well, Professor Sokol, lots of comparisons being made now to the 1960s civil rights movement protests, including at some of the demonstrations we saw here in New Hampshire over the weekend. Older folks had signs saying, I've been here before, here I am again. What similarities do you see, Professor Sokol?
Well, the most obvious similarity is that these protests we've seen for the past couple of weeks have been massive, sustained, unceasing. And most of them, at least in the past 10 days or so, have also been quite nonviolent. So I think it's a show of basically civil disobedience in the streets that the country has not seen on this scale or with this intensity since the 1960s.
And Professor Delmont, what do you think? We talked about the 40s earlier. What about parallels to the 60s?
I think the ones Jason pointed to are exactly right. I think the thing that sort of strikes me is in terms of, it's more of a difference than a parallel, is that there isn't a single leader you can point to here. So I think a lot of people ask, where's the Martin Luther King for this generation? But I think it's purposeful that Black Lives Matter has tried to create a more decentralized organizing structure so that you have people leading these different marches all over the country, whether it's New Hampshire or any other state. Who are local leaders who can talk to their local communities, and actually creates a stronger network for maintaining large-scale protests and activism.
Oh, that's really interesting. Talk a little bit more about that, Professor Delmont. The fact that there isn't one sort of crystallizing leader and the definitely the benefits that you just mentioned, but also if there are issues that come up around that.
I think it's actually one of the ways we kind of misremember the civil rights movement, that Martin Luther King was such a powerful speaker, and he was certainly the most prominent national figure in the 1960s, but he was by no means the only civil rights activist. And I think you could read Jason's book or any of my books on this, that there were very important local activists all across the country who were the ones who actually made these marches, the key marches in the 1960s, happen. But because King was such a powerful speaker, when we look back and at the documentaries and the sort of sound bites we take from that era, we kind of focus in on him. That kind of limits us today, because people continually ask, where is the King? I think the power of the model that people have now is that it doesn't rely on one person. That you, I think over the weekend, or there have been now over 700 different cities across the country that have had protests in the last 2 weeks. That just isn't possible with a single national figurehead. So I think it speaks to the power of this local leadership. I think the only limitation I could see is there still is a tendency within national media to want to put the microphone in front of one person's face and have a single person sort of speak for Black America. I think that's an outdated model. It was an outdated model in the 1960s, but I think it frustrates media to not have a single person to be able to point to.
Very interesting. And I want to ask both of you a lot more about that, but let's take a call. This is Mary Lynn in Portsmouth. Hi, Mary Lynn. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, hi. Yes, my name is Mary Lynn, but when I'm in New England, which I have been now for 50 years, I go by ML because people don't do double names that much up here. So I'm a Southerner and have a lot of experience in civil rights, marching, and advocacy. And I was just talking to a neighbor yesterday, a young neighbor of mine, and we were talking about, I said, well, you know, and I marched a few days ago. And he was like, you've been through this before, right? Because you lived through the 60s. I said, oh, yeah, I lived through the 60s. I also grew up in the South and the Midwest. I was an Army brat and moved a lot and saw racial equality some places, and then just became a very big civil rights activist.
So, ML, given your long history of marching and demonstrating and so forth, what sort of comparisons are you pulling out with what has been happening over the past week or so?
I'm thrilled with the amount of Black, brown, and white together that I'm seeing throughout the whole nation, and even here in a little white Portsmouth and Kittery. And I think that the fact that it's in all 50 states and that we have a lot of people coming out and starting to apologize for what they've done recently is very, I don't know, I want to say hopeful, but we've been here before, and I do worry about that. This does seem different, though, to me.
Well, ML, thank you very much for calling in. It kind of reminds me of what Professor Delmont said earlier. How you feel kind of depends on the day, in one sense. Both of you, to you first, Professor Sokol, in one sense, ML says she's thrilled by, as she put it, the amount of Black, brown, and white people demonstrating together. What have we seen in the past, Professor Sokol, especially with your expertise in the 1960s civil rights movements?
Well, I think for, one of the things that was extraordinary about the 1960s civil rights movement was the extent of white Americans who participated, although I do have to say there were not many white Southerners who participated, certainly not in the 50s and early 60s in the civil rights movement. And I don't actually know the stats on these current protests, whether the level of white support sort of varies in terms of whether you're talking about a city or a state that happens to be more progressive or more liberal. But certainly it's extraordinary to all of us that white people are also in the streets. And the important thing also, I think, is that African Americans lead the movement and sort of make the demands and set the terms and the framework of their own struggle. And that it's, I think, to the extent that, that white people are going to be active and involved, it's important that they take up the demands that are set forth by African-Americans themselves, if that makes sense.
Professor Delmont, I'd love your thoughts, too, on what ML says. And ML, thank you again for calling.
Yeah, I would agree with the caller. I think one of the things that struck me over the last couple weeks is the composition, the demographic composition of these marches, and having people out in the streets for over 2 weeks. It's not just sort of a one-off or a single day protest, but having them out in the street for 2 weeks. And the fact that a lot of these protests are happening in places that don't have substantial African-American population. So having people recognize this as an issue that they want to become an ally and support the issues of police violence against Black people and against brown communities, I think is really powerful.
ML, thanks again for the call. And again, let's hear from you. If you participated in earlier movements for racial justice or civil rights, we'd like to hear how you view what's going on currently. And if you're new to all this, what lessons are you drawing from those previous times in our history that we're learning about today in the exchange? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Professor Sokol, I'd love for you to comment on what Professor Delmont said earlier about in the 1960s, while there were many, many people who obviously were involved in driving this civil rights movement, most people, you know, today focus on Martin Luther King. And as Professor Delmont said, people today are saying, where's the king? Where's the king? How do you hear, Professor Sokol, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. being invoked during this time, either in ways that you feel are appropriate or off base? And go ahead, Professor Sokol.
Right. I mean, first to respond what Professor Delmont was saying, I think he's exactly right that part of the power of this movement is how local and decentralized it is. I mean, what's important for the protesters, I think, is that they don't necessarily need a single individual to rally around, but if they do want legislation at the federal level, they will need to have unified demands that people in hundreds of different cities sort of agree to and want to press on, that they want to see pass. In terms of King being invoked, certainly at the beginning when there were episodes of looting and violence, King is always invoked in a sort of cliched way by people who want to claim that King was nonviolent and that he would supposedly have opposed all violence. It is true that King was opposed to the use of violence, but if you look at his own writings in 1967 and 68, when hundreds of cities in America were going up in flames, King was more concerned with condemning the people in power who were failing to address the conditions in American cities than he was concerned with condemning individual looters, for instance. So you can take King's own words, and one thing that he said was that the evil of passivity in face of injustice was equal to him as the evil of violence. So he thought that inaction was the real sin.
That's interesting. I really want to hear from you too, Professor Delmont, on this, how we hear Martin Luther King Jr. Being referenced, being invoked at this time.
Yeah, I would just pick up where Jason said. I think people like to selectively quote Martin Luther King Jr. a lot without necessarily reading his work in great detail. So I think one of the best examples of this is the I Have a Dream speech. Almost everyone quotes that very short piece about the not judging people by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. But it's actually an 18-minute long speech, and he discusses many things that are really what we describe today as being structural racism issues. And I can't stop thinking about the one, his reference to what he calls the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. That's in his most famous speech, but for most people, they don't think of that part when they think of Martin Luther King. So I think it depends a lot on what parts of King you're quoting in terms of what to kind of point you're trying to make.
Yeah, there's that quote. I've got it in front of me from the I Have a Dream speech. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. So that's from the I Have a Dream speech, not widely quoted, as you were both saying. Let's take another call, gentlemen. This is Sheila in Putney, Vermont. Hi, Sheila. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. I hope I don't get disconnected. I have a bad connection. But anyway,
all right.
The point that I really think needs to be brought up too, and I apologize if you just said it and I missed it while I was making the connection, is the importance of youth leadership today as well as in the 60s. I mean, the whole thing with the Montgomery, in Montgomery, and, you know, students were really important to Martin Luther King, and the movement would not have been what it was without leadership from youth.
Sheila, this is a really important point. Yeah. Thank you very much for calling in. And Professor Sokol, I know you've written about this, so go ahead, please.
Well, I think in terms of the 1960s, really the beating heart of the civil rights movement was SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I mean, that was the organization that sent field organizers to the deepest reaches of the rural South and empowered African Americans to attempt to register to vote and so on. And those were, you know, that was led by, it began with the student sit-ins in Greensboro, North Carolina. And it was led by students as young as 18, 19. And those are the people who put their lives on the line. So I think the caller has it exactly right in that respect.
Yeah, Professor Delmont, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And to address it more in the kind of present day moment, I was wrapping up one of my history classes here at Dartmouth, and one of the students, we're talking about everything that's going on, and one of the students mentioned that, is an African-American student, mentioned that he was 12 years old when Trayvon Martin got killed in 2012. And it hadn't really occurred to me in quite this way, but this generation, folks who are in their teens and early 20s now, has really grown up with both very visible cases of Black people being killed by police or by white citizens acting as though they were police. But also they've grown up with protests. They've grown up with the Black Lives Matter protests over nearly the last decade. And so I think you have, what you're seeing right now is sort of an outpouring of people who are just, of young people who are just fed up with seeing this and having this be part of really the majority of their lives at this point, these killings, but also understanding that you can't just let these things happen, that you have to organize and you have to be active to fight back. I think it's very powerful to see the number of young people out in the streets now, but also to make the connections to all the young people who fought so hard for these issues in the 60s.
Sheila, thank you for the call. Jim in Grantham wrote in. He says, why did the protests stop after 1968, even though social conditions became worse? Jim, thank you very much for writing in. And again, I'd love hearing from both of you on this. Professor Delmont, you first, please.
Sure. This is a big and difficult question. One thing I would point to would be, let me point to two things. One would be the kind of changing political winds. So when President Nixon gets elected in 1968, he runs on a law and order platform, which we've seen President Trump reinvoke this language. It's really a euphemism for keeping Black people in their place. But because the country kind of takes on this more conservative bent, it takes the wind out of the sails of a lot of the African-American activists who'd been pushing for so long. They'd achieved some very important legislative victories in the 1960s, the Civil Rights Act of 64 and 68, the Voting Rights Act of 65. But that sort of, how do we move it forward and sort of address the next stage? The political winds are going against them by the early 1970s. Vietnam War comes to take a huge amount of the spending that might otherwise go to public programs, what had been Johnson's Great Society programs. But then the last thing I would say is the tremendous amount of state and police violence and repression against Black activists. So Black Panther Party forms in the late 1960s. The amount of federal money and power that's spent trying to disband Black Panthers and similarly minded activists is just immense. And so that puts a tremendous amount of pressure on Black people who want to continue fighting these fights, that it's literally not physically safe to be out in the streets or to raise your voice too much on a lot of these issues by the 1970s.
Wow, a hefty question, Jim. Thank you for writing in. So just to make sure I got it right, Professor Delmont, so, you know, white Americans get nervous about violence, so they support a sort of law and order approach. At the same time, the Vietnam War becomes more of a focus, so that takes energy and resources away from this fight against racism. Do I have that right, Professor Delmont?
Yes. Yeah.
Professor Sokol, I'd love your thoughts on this too. Jim asked a great question.
Well, thank you for giving me a few minutes to think about it, because
it's hefty. Yeah.
It is a complicated one, but I have a few different responses to it. One is that It is true that the mass protests stopped, but there were still all sorts of protests. They just didn't attract the national media attention, partially because there was no, partially because King had been assassinated in 68. There was no longer a national figurehead to focus on. SNCC had also basically become an all-Black organization and didn't have the interracial nature of the earlier incarnation of SNCC. But I would also say that there were still a great deal of civil rights advances in the early and mid-1970s, and there was still a great deal of protests. For instance, a lot of the schools in the rural South didn't integrate till 1970, 71, and that was in the face of ongoing protests and then Supreme Court decisions, particularly the decision of Alexander versus Holmes. Then also, if you look at northern cities, I mean, the struggle over desegregation in Boston was really fought in the 70s. So I think a lot of what Matt said is exactly right, that in the face of the Nixon administration and the FBI crackdown, protesters had to fear for their lives. Also, you had right-wing protests in the streets. Think about the Hard Hat Riot in 1970 after the Kent State shootings. This is when right-wing protesters got in the streets and actually did physically assault sort of anti-war protesters. So that speaks to the fact that there was a real added danger to it all.
Wow. Well, Jim, thank you again for writing in. And after a short break, we'd love to take more of your calls and emails. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email exchange at nhpr.org. We'll also talk more with our guests about comparing protests past and protests now. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, drawing parallels between the racial justice movement that's growing now and movements in America's past, the 1940s, the 60s, the 90s. Exchange listeners, we'd love to hear from you. If you participated in earlier protest movements for racial justice or civil rights, what is your view on what's going on right now? And if you're new to all this activism, what lessons do you draw from those previous times in our history? Send us an email. That's exchange@nhpr.org. You can comment on Facebook, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Both of our guests have written widely on civil rights movements in America. They are Matthew Delmont, a professor of history at Dartmouth College. His forthcoming book is called Half American, The Epic Story of African Americans Fighting World War II at Home and Abroad. Also with us, Jason Sokol, an associate professor of history at UNH, and the author of several books, including All Eyes Are Upon Us, Race and Politics, From Boston to Brooklyn, The Conflicted Soul of the Northeast. And both of you, let's go right back to our listeners. Anne is waiting in Newcastle on the line. Hi, Anne. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. And I'm Anne without an E.
Okay.
That's very important at election time. Anyhow, I've been there and done that. In 1968, I protested quietly as one of the employees at Thompson Hall in Durham. For many Thursdays at 1 p.m., employees, students, professors, and occasionally the President, John McConnell, stood with us, and we were silent for 15 minutes, and no one ever interrupted us, and we never had riots, but that was our protest against the Vietnam War. We had students at the time who had come back from Vietnam and made it very important that we be against the war. Ironically, that was the year of the Hong Kong flu, which actually killed 100,000 Americans, we found out later, because they didn't keep such good records in those days. But it was under another global pandemic, and it's still going around the air nowadays, even though people don't get it very often.
Well, Anne, given your history, what are your reflections or observations on what we see around us today in terms of these racial justice protests?
We haven't come very far. That was also the year, I think, that Martin Luther King died, and he was a great man and a great leader. But as some people are saying now, there are leaders in many cities. 700 cities have had these riots or protests, and possibly within their own area, there will be great leadership that comes forward, and I sincerely hope so.
Well, Anne, it's great to... go ahead.
One of the people that we knew at the university at that time was a young man from the South who resettled in the North because he had worked with the civil rights movement in the South, and they all thought it was not safe for him to stay there any longer. So he came up North and worked at the Memorial Union in the kitchen.
Oh, well, Anne, it's really good to hear from you. Did you want to say his name, Anne?
His name was Dave Kitt. And for many years, he sat outside Breaking New Grounds in Portsmouth and sort of held court and told the story of his life and how he passed on his good values to his children.
Well, Anne, it's really good to hear from you. And I really want to pick up on something she said. Professor Delmont, to you first. I have heard this from older folks over the past week or two, reflecting what Anne said. We haven't come very far. So, you know, some people are excited about the multiracial aspect of these protests and the young aspect and the young energy that's been putting in. But some older people are watching them and saying, why are we still seeing this? We haven't come very far. And I just wonder how you view that, Professor Delmont.
I think that's largely right. I think one important thing, and it kind of goes back to an earlier point about recognizing this has been an ongoing issue for Black and Latino communities, this being sort of police violence and then the kind of structural racism that these communities endure. We know what a lot of the problems are. So looking back at the 1960s, there was a report that President Johnson commissioned called the Kerner Commission report that tried to get to the bottom of why these riots happened in the late 1960s. And they found pretty clearly the issues of sort of structural racism that bound Black communities in ghettos and denied them equal life chances, denied jobs, fair housing, equal schools. The problem was trying to have the political will to actually put in place the solutions that were recommended. And we've seen that sort of time and again after the 60s rebellions, after the Rodney King riots, even in the 2010s with the first wave of Black Lives Matter protests, there was a large amount of media attention to it, a large amount of expressions of concern, like this is really a problem, but then not a lot of substantive policy changes to address the root causes and the root issues. And so I think when we say, you know, it's frustrating that we're here again, I think it's up to us to determine whether or not this is going to be a turning point.
Professor Sokol, how do you interpret that feeling of defeat that we heard from our caller, Anne, and that we've heard from other people, you know, who feel like they tried so hard 50 years ago and the same problems persist?
Well, it's another complex question, but I would highlight the fact that our history, particularly around Black struggle, has really been one characterized by great advances and also tremendous defeats. And so you don't have a sort of straight line of injustice running through our history. You have these moments like emancipation and reconstruction sort of step forward, or some of the civil rights gains of the 1960s, great leap forward, but then that were then followed by sort of awful repression and steps back. I think, you know, I am torn about where to place President Obama's election and re-election within the long arc of sort of the Black struggle, because the beginning of the Black Lives Matter movement happened on Obama's watch, right? Michael Brown's death and Tamir Rice's and Freddie Gray's and the others. And the Obama administration, though, did start to investigate those police departments, right? The Ferguson Police Department, the Baltimore Police Department. And then after the election of 2016, Department of Justice stopped those investigations. The Obama administration was also pressing to try to enforce aspects of the Fair Housing Act that was passed in 1968, but hadn't been enforced. And then the new administration rolled those back. So I would certainly agree that police brutality has been ongoing and that has festered throughout. But I think there are some ways in which the country achieved some sorts of progress only to be followed by sort of those gains being vacated or turned back.
Got an email from a listener who says, I'd like to have the guest speak a little bit more about legislation at the federal level. This person says, if this is a struggle that's been going on for hundreds of years, would federal law make a difference? For example, getting legislation passed like the Emmett Till bill. And I want to thank that listener for writing in. And Professor Delmont, you first?
I'll take a crack at it, but I should preface by saying this is not a research specialization of mine. So
sure.
It's beyond the bounds of my direct research knowledge. But I should say that from most of what I understand, these tend to be more local and state level decisions being made with regards, if we're talking about sort of police issues and how police departments are managed. Those tend to be more local and state level than federal. I think there are likely to be federal legislative approaches that could create space for different communities to take it at different approaches. But I think most of the battles I've seen taking place are specific cities and specific activists in cities trying to address what's going on with their police forces. So it tends to be happening at the local level.
The question also makes me wonder, Professor Delmont, you know, as we talk about not just the police brutality, but other issues, you know, jobs, housing, healthcare, and so forth. Have we seen times in the past, Professor Delmont, where a federal law did make a difference?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the key gains of the civil rights era, Jason spoke to this nicely, that having the different demands of local activists coalesce into something that can be actually put on the national policy agenda is extremely important. That's one of the kind of key victories that came out of the 1960s, the Civil Rights Act and fair housing legislation. And none of those were perfect, but they all were extremely important in terms of providing a firmer foundation for African Americans to have equal access to jobs, housing, schools. Those take a lot of political organizing, and then take political will and courage from elected officials. I think that's the thing that activists have to be able to push for, is getting politicians to see these issues as ones that are important, even if they might only directly impact 15-20% of the electorate, that they're things that they're morally important for the country, that even if they might only impact a relatively small percentage of the electorate.
Well, thanks to that person for writing in. And another caller, Alan in New Boston, is on the line. Hi, Alan. Thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, so, you know, I grew up in the 50s and 60s. I saw all this stuff about civil rights. I did marches. I marched against the war in Vietnam. I watched the police club people time after time. Not much has changed since then. Sure, we've had some laws passed, but it hasn't really had much effect. If you ask a black person how much effect it's had on their life, they will tell you not much at all. So I want to know, what do you think is going to happen this time?
Yeah, it's a great question, Alan. Thank you so much. And so, Professor Sokol, here we are hearing that sentiment again. You know, not that much has changed. And what do you think will happen this time? I'm asking you to step out of your role a little bit, Professor Sokol, as a historian. But does this moment feel different, or will we have this conversation 5 years from now and say nothing has changed?
I am skeptical of the sort of nothing has changed view. I mean, I think civil rights veterans like John Lewis, for instance, they put their lives and their bodies on the line, and they gained some things that were really important. For instance, voting, federal voting rights. Now, some states have turned back those rights. The White House has led a crusade against voting rights now, but it still doesn't mean that their sacrifice was in vain, for instance. So I understand where somebody like that is coming from. To your question, Laura, I mean, is this different? It feels different than anything I've lived through. I mean, I didn't live through a civil rights movement. So I have not seen this sustained and intense level of mass mobilization in the streets in the name of racial justice before. So to me, it feels different, and we can only hope that it carries on and that the protesters and the movement is able to achieve some of what it wishes.
Last question for you, Professor Delmont. You're a historian. What do historians look at while they're living through themselves a moment that will definitely be one for the history books? Are you like watching the news and taking notes or what?
Pretty much. I mean, I think we're often looking for the things that will be the kind of primary sources that we can use in the future. And so that's the individual speeches or the pictures or the videos or the tweets in the present day that will help us get a sort of a clear sense of what was it like to live through this moment, things that we can 20 years, 30 years down the road, be able to explain to our students, you know, here's what it was like to be alive in 2020, and trying to sort of bring together the sort of constellation of coming out of the COVID-19 lockdown and then into these massive protests. I think the thing historians are also obsessed with is how does the story end? And so that we don't know yet. I think for me, thinking about whether now is different or not, none of us know. I think it's going to depend on what happens in the next 3 and 6 months. If history is a judge, I think the important thing is maintaining the sense of urgency, that 2 weeks from now, 3 weeks from now, the media cycle will change. Something else will come up that will dominate this show and other shows. But the issues will still be there. The issues of police violence and police brutality will still be there. And if the people who are marching right now and who care about this issue right now maintain that sense of urgency 6 months, a year from now, I think that will be the mark that this was a turning point.
Well, it's been really good to talk to both of you. Matthew Delmont, thank you very much. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
That's Matthew Delmont, professor of history at Dartmouth College. His forthcoming book is Half American, the epic story of African Americans fighting World War II at home and abroad. Jason Sokol, it was good to have you too. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jason Sokol is an associate professor of history at UNH and the author of several books, including All Eyes Are Upon Us, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn. You can join NHPR today at noon for live coverage for George Floyd's funeral in Houston, Texas. His killing, as you all know, in Minneapolis sparked worldwide protests and charges against four former police officers. NHPR is going to broadcast Houston Public Media's coverage of the service. So that's today, beginning at noon on NHPR. Thanks for being with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.